Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm your host, Thomas Richardson, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. The HHN podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past. Here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Now, does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that. It's complicated. But it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun and relatable. So let's get started. So in today's podcast, I want to talk about a really interesting topic that, you know, I've kind of been fascinated about for almost the past year. So I watch a lot of American Experience documentaries on PBS, and one of them, they recently featured a show called C-Lab. And I remember once that I used to watch this show called C-Lab 2021, you know, for all those old school people who watch Adult Swim, you know, you probably know what I'm talking about. But, you know, at first I thought it was C-Lab, you know, I thought, you know, this was just a show on, you know, Adult Swim. You know, what else could this have been? But as I did some more digging and watching after watching this documentary, I came to realize that this was an actual U.S. Navy program in the 60s. And it was fairly well documented, and it was really interesting in the amount of sciences that were involved and how undersea exploration expanded because of this program. And so I was really fascinated and encouraged to learn more about this topic. And the work that I have done on this, you know, it was really the brainchild of one person, and his name was Dr. George Foote Bond. And so throughout his career, Dr. Bond envisioned people living in the ocean, you know, but not just in submarines or in those old school diving bells, but he actually imagined people literally living in the ocean, fully furnished environments where people could eat, sleep, you know, and work for weeks at a time. You know, much of what the ocean offered, you know, in terms of scientific research was really immense in the mid-20th century. You know, there were more people interested in learning about outer space than there were about actually exploring the oceans. Now, there were a few notable personalities, you know, pioneers like Jacques Cousteau. You know, they led conservation efforts and developed novel aquatic technology like the aqualung. You know, underwater explorers had still only glimpsed what was barely beneath the waves. You know, it used to be that the deepest that a person got was they just swam for as deep as however long they could hold their breath, and that was it. So the barrier between expanding a lot of these horizons was overcoming a lot of the physical and psychological limitations of the human body. And that was the entire career for Dr. Bond. He wanted to really push those limits and finding that answer. So to scale back a little bit, Bond, he was a really well-loved doctor in North Carolina. He was profiled by the American Medical Association for his services in rural counties, and they even proclaimed him Doctor of the Year by his local community. But underneath that, there was this real drive to understand more about the natural world. And in 1953, Bond actually joined the U.S. Navy's Medical Corps and was certified as diving and submarine medical officer. And it was during a lot of these early years that Bond became enamored with diving and undersea exploration. So the Navy actually runs this special division within the medical branch called the Naval Medical Research Lab that still operates today in New London, Connecticut. So if any Navy or Coast Guard veterans are out there, you'll recognize the name New London, Connecticut very well. So Bond collected data on all the effects of underwater pressure on the human body and novel diving techniques. In a lot of his practices, he eventually invented this technique called the blow-and-go. And the blow-and-go method was where if endangered submarine crews, if they wanted to safely exit the craft whenever they sustained damage and basically wanted to keep from, you know, sinking with the submarine to the ocean floor, they developed this method where by having life jackets around their necks and by continually exhaling air, the water pressure would eventually expand the oxygen in their lungs and actually propel them to shoot up faster to the ocean surface, which was really quite interesting. So Bond was obsessed with this other theory of what he called saturation diving. So, and if, for all those experienced divers out there, this is where actually where this term comes from. So Bonnet argued that as divers descended deeper underwater and as their bodies absorbed the maximum amount of gas molecules, decompression time would still remain static. So in underwater habitat, pressure rise to appropriate depth was needed in order to allow divers to live in that environment. So once a diver actually got to a certain depth and they're acclimatized to that with a correct breathing mixture, theoretically, a person could just stay on the ocean floor for however long they needed. Because the human body acted in many ways, what Bond realized, was like a sponge. You know, they could only absorb so much, but they could still safely expel and recalibrate to eventually reacclimatize themselves to the ocean surface. So under direction from the Secretary of the Navy and the National Naval Medical Research Lab, Bond and his colleague, Walter Mazzone, started on what they called the Genesis Project. So Genesis' goals were developing safe breathing mixtures in a pressurized environment for divers and to help determine the amount needed time needed for decompression. So they couldn't just use normal regular air that like we breathe every day. That would have been too concentrated and actually too deadly because, as I learned over the course of this research, was that oxygen toxicity, the thing that we always oxygen that we'd always talked about, being the essential to life, oxygen toxicity, was very prevalent, and too much oxygen can definitely kill you. So these were two puzzles crucial to Bond saturation theory. His colleague, Mazzone, developed a gas mixture comprised primarily of helium with still small levels of oxygen and nitrogen. So because they could still be compressed tightly enough to be in a pressurized environment while still providing enough oxygen to help the oxygen and nitrogen to help the divers, basically keep them from suffocating. So after various trials with test animals, and of course these first ones dying from oxygen toxicity, as I just explained, the project moved on to human testing, and a lot of volunteers were observed inside the pressure chamber conducting experiments for specific lengths of time. And this project took a number of years, and I was actually was very surprised by the length of this time. So between 1957 and 63, the Genesis Project gathered a mountain of data on atmospheric and environmental conditions. Test subjects and Navy divers Robert Barth, Sanders Manning, Raymond Lavoie, and John Bull endured a battery of varying breathing mixtures, but after their longest endurance of 12 days at 198 feet of seawater, or what they called 7 atmospheres of pressure, they'd actually proven that saturation diving was a viable concept. A person could indeed live underwater in a controlled environment indefinitely. And Bond later presented these findings in an article on environmental health where he says, and quote, "As a result of some 6 years of animal and human studies involving closed ecological systems, elevated pressures, and synthetic atmospheres, the stage had been set for operational application of the work. Now, it would appear that we could safely station men at any point on the submerged continental shelf with a reasonable expectancy of useful performance for prolonged periods of time." And there it was, right there in that moment, Bond was on his way to creating C-Lab. Now, with atmospheric testing completed, constructing a suitable habitat was the next step. So the Navy at this point, while they had authorized the project, were still not necessarily committing a lot of resources to it in its early days because they didn't know if it would actually work. And so they didn't want to commit, millions and millions of dollars to a project that may not produce results. So Bond and his team searched through old shipyards, and they eventually found 2 old depth charge sweepers. Now, these were large cylindrical structures that actually proved to be the perfect size. So they had welders and engineers improvise and joining the shells, and they produced what was basically like this really long cigar, big metallic cigar, that eventually became their habitat. They outfitted it with bunk beds, they put in some kitchen appliances, and even a bathroom, and a small workspace for recording their data. The setup was crude, but it was all that the divers needed. And actually, the water delivery system was just a basic garden hose. The burner plates and much of the other kitchen appliances were all provided by Radio Shack. You know, they were really doing this on a budget. So, you know, it was a relatively simple design at first, but this Manatee program showing that a person could live on the ocean floor. So by July of 1964, Sealab 1, as it was codenamed, and its crew were sent to the coast of Bermuda to test the new habitat. Well, Bermuda, that sounds really amazing right now. But during this preparation, they got an immense public relations boost. And that came in the form of Malcolm Scott Carpenter. Now, why does that name sound familiar? Well, if you're a space nut, Scott Carpenter was a decorated Navy commander and Mercury astronaut who had actually, around this time, had just completed an orbit around the Earth. And he became immensely interested in marine conservation, and he actually met Jacques Cousteau while attending a lecture at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. And that was when he got involved in hearing about George Bond and their Sealab work. Now, Carpenter had actually really looked forward to participating in the first Sealab expedition, but he ended up was sidelined with a motorcycle accident 2 days before. But then on July 20th, the habitat was lowered almost 200 feet into the ocean. And these consisted of four main divers: Robert Thompson, Lester Anderson, Robert Barth, and Sanders Manning, some of these guys who had already spent time with the Genesis Project. And they spent their days swimming around in the surrounding waters, recording data, and documenting issues with the Sealab capsule. You know, were there any leaks? Were they able to, get food and water? Were they able to still have the correct breathing mixture? Were they, document any kind of environmental problems? Now, there were some problems arose concerning the internal temperature, humidity, communications, and a lot of these divers had to improvise a lot of the repair work. You know, when we think of the, we think about some of the astronauts who had to, jerry-rig a way to, come back to the Earth using just the instruments that they had. Well, this was really this, very similar fashion to these divers. You know, they couldn't, if they didn't have anything else on them, they had to find a way to fix it. So, and a lot of these divers and some of the old videos that they had from the old Navy reels, a lot of these divers, they're not walking around in their clothes. They're actually walking around half naked because they had to crank up the temperature so high inside the habitat because helium didn't retain heat. And so you see these guys that are just sitting around just sweating their butts off, which, number one is uncomfortable, but number two, that really had to smell after just a few days. So, but now at this time, there were still tropical storms they had to worry about. One was moving towards Bermuda, less than 2 weeks into the project, which cut their schedule short. But during those days, the Bond and the diving team proved that the person could live and work in an underwater pressurized environment. And this was the final validation for Bond's theory for saturation diving. Now, we're going to shift a little bit away from Sealab itself to the broader historical context. Oh, this might be, some of you are thinking, oh, geez, he's going to go on some long rant about the Cold War and the Soviet Union, maybe. And it's like, well, yeah, because that's important to understand here. So Bond's research was crucial in the United States competition with the Soviet Union. He didn't know it, but his work would actually go on to have numerous historical implications. So the Cold War influenced scientific research within the U.S. Armed Forces, and there were throngs of researchers that embarked on a flurry of defense work to gain advantages. So there are many confrontations were most likely to occur at sea, and with modern navies transitioning to nuclear-powered ships and submarines, the race for oceanic dominance, took the forefront. Deep sea diving was given a high priority because it had the potential for underwater rescues. It had the potential for, espionage work. Geopolitical factors now played a role in the success of research like Bonds and C-Lab. So not only did they need them to produce for results, they needed to produce flawless results. Now, with the success of C-Lab 1, the Navy immediately authorized Bond to begin work on C-Lab 2. They saw what they had achieved in Bermuda, and they believed, oh, this has great promise. Now we need to go to the next step. Bond received an enormous increase in his budget from the Navy. He also received the Legion of Merit Medal, which was a nice causal as well. The design and construction of the second habitat comprised a full year and made improvements on a lot of the schematics. So they added heating coils and air conditioning units to help regulate temperature and humidity. They even installed a full walk-in refrigerator to store perishable foods, and they expanded a larger laboratory because they were also going to start doing some marine research as well. So documenting, the local sea life. And now by this point, Scott Carpenter had fully recovered from his accident the year before, and as soon as he was able to walk, he jumped on board to join the C-Lab team in La Jolla, California, ready to transition from astronaut to aquanaut. The first team of divers moved into the habitat on August 28, 1965, along with Carpenter with them. Now, two separate teams worked 15 days each in the habitat, but Carpenter, Carpenter, he remained the entire 30-day duty. Now, this world was completely different from the warm waters of Bermuda. In fact, everything seems different from the warm waters of Bermuda because that sounds really nice right now. So the freezing temperatures and pitch black darkness obscured all the divers' work. Now, the marine life also posed dangers as well. Jellyfish, pufferfish, and others penetrated wetsuits. And even Carpenter himself, was stung by some of these dangerous fish, leaving him a painful welt that left him up in bed for a couple of days. But despite these challenges, the C-Lab 2 team made headlines for their achievements, including even a celebratory phone call from President Lyndon Johnson. Imagine having that call from the president into your underwater habitat. But you should also realize that because we're in an all-helium environment, the president is hearing these squeaky noises over the phone and what should have been a historic moment. LBJ calling them is like, gentlemen, I'd like to congratulate you for your work in this C-Lab endeavor.
Thank you, Mr. President. This truly is a wonderful honor.
I mean, Johnson had to be surprised after hearing that.
He's like, this is such a great honor to leave here, Mr. President. The Navy is doing such wonderful, great things.
Oh, yeah. That would have been driven me nuts. So C-Lab 2, in addition to collecting more data on saturation, diving, and pressurization, they tested new electrically heated wetsuits, and they conducted salvage ops off of the California coast. And by this time, the Navy just wanted to test one more project with the C-Lab crew. It wasn't a new diver or new equipment, it was a bottlenose dolphin named Tuffy. Now, we all want to hear about, the role of animals with the armed forces, and we hear about, war dogs or the passenger pigeons, but this time we recruited a dolphin? Well, this was actually true. The Navy's marine mammal program trained animals to assist Navy personnel in a lot of rudimentary tasks, and in this case of C-Lab, the bottlenose dolphin Tuffy was trained to ferry supplies between the divers and the habitat. Now, these results were mixed. Tuffy didn't always make it to the lab or always didn't make it to shore, but it was well enough to retrain Tuffy for the next project. So C-Lab 2 completed its mission on October 10th, 1965, and the future really looked bright for George Bond and his crew. Underwater exploration, deep-sea diving operations, they seemed to be of greater importance in the Cold War context because humans were going further than they had ever thought possible. Now, all this, though, did not protect C-Lab from outside forces, whether they were political or social. Around this time, like we said, in the late 60s, along with the Cold War, we have an even bigger menace, which is the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War consumed an ever-climbing cost of men, resources, and so funding for programs like C-Lab, they were given a lower priority. You know, everyone was putting men and material out to Southeast Asia. You know, experienced sailors and divers and engineers were being transferred to the South China Sea. And this was an enormous cost to Bond and his work. It left them in complete disarray. And wouldn't it be for also another 4 years before they got enough funding to become available for a third C-Lab? Now, of course, always wanting to improve upon the past, Bond upgraded the C-Lab's 2 habitat in order for divers to conduct salvage operations and even do fishery studies. But out of these optimistic goals, though, the problems constantly set the C-Lab team back. There were construction delays, caused the majority of the problems. Now, they had issues, of course, with the bureaucracy, administration, and, of course, they were always redesigning things, and everyone was always on the same page because they were implementing new types of seals, gaskets, pressurized containers, and electrical lines were always changing specifications. And the result was a lot of ill-fitting parts causing air leaks in the main cabin, which left unresolved could have had resulted in divers asphyxiating or causing explosive decompression. Now, the project exceeded budget and cost, further irritating Bond, and a date for submersion was finally set for February 15, 1969. 5 teams of divers served 12 days rotations off the coast of San Clemente Island in California again. But another sudden change caught the C-Lab team off guard, and this was moving into an unprecedented depth of 600 feet or 18 atmospheres of pressure. Now, this was a huge concern for Bond because all previous tests had not occurred at that depth. And so he himself was unsure that whether this project would actually go forward, and the failure likelihood of failure was higher than ever. So divers were lowered in the water, but their insulated suits were not adequate enough to keep them warm, because the lower you go, the colder it's going to be. The Kuiper in cold water sapped their strength, and they were arrived at the habitat, and even more problems they faced. An interior neoprene seal failed, causing helium to leak from the chamber, just as Bond had feared. Unable to raise the habitat back to the surface, the diver needed to repair the seal themselves. And this is where we finally had C-Lab's first casualty, Barry L. Cannon. Now, Barry was an electronics engineer, and all of a sudden, one of the divers reported that they heard this enormous scream underwater. You know, one of them thought, what the heck was that? He began convulsing and struggling to breathe, and Barth tried forcing their breathers into his mouth, but the muscle contractions kept Cannon from opening his mouth, and they moved back to the diving bell to try and resuscitate him, but it was too late. The body was transferred to the San Diego Naval Hospital, where the final autopsy indicated that the cause of death was carbon dioxide poisoning. Now, an inquiry board, like everything else with the military, a board was set up to establish and evaluate the events leading up to the tragedy. And they learned that Cannon's diving rig wasn't functioning. The carbon dioxide beryllium scrubber was empty, meaning that carbon dioxide couldn't be expelled from within the system. Now, when that happens, it creates a backlog within the breathing mixture, causing CO2 levels to rise and not be properly expelled. This meant that Cannon was actively breathing in concentrated CO2. They also saw that hypothermia was a main contributing factor given the extremely cold water. But his death finally foreshadowed the death of C-Lab. As family and fellow teammates mourned his loss, there were potential culprits but were never prosecuted. No one actually knew who inspected his diving rig or approved any other change with their program, but officially the U.S. Navy ruled his death as an accident, but outside geopolitical forces still arguably prevented them from arresting anyone at fault. Because a year prior, on January 23rd, 1968, the ship the USS Puebla was captured by North Korean forces, marking a major incident in the Cold War. John Craven, head of the Navy's Deep Submergence Systems Program, claimed that any other negative press about the U.S. Navy wouldn't be tolerated. So first they lose a ship captured by North Korean communist forces, and then all of a sudden a diver dies on their watch trying to do an underwater C-Lab program. how Cannon's death coupled with the escalating war in Vietnam and, of course, this bad press, the C-Lab program ended, and they scrapped the C-Lab 3 habitat. Now, all this isn't to say that Bond's dream of underwater living did not die with C-Lab, though. In fact, it did the opposite. In subsequent years, other governments and even the private sector took lessons gained from Bond's work and applied it to their own. You know, saturation diving meant that people could function underwater for extended periods of time and open novel ways of working in the ocean. This applied not only to private corporations wanting to work and use the oceanic resources, but also for marine research, for ocean conservationists, for those wanting to study all forms of aquatic life. You know, saturation diving would allow them to spend more time underwater, and that meant more time allowed for research, more time allowed for gathering data, and really more time to experience what they needed to accomplish. Now, today, the Office of Naval Research and its Undersea Medicine Program relies heavily on Bond's work. You know, this was work done over 60 years ago, and they still use it today. They use it on their experiments in testing human endurance in underwater environments. Marine conservation groups rely on it to document natural man-made disasters in the ocean to help promote oceanic health. And so when it comes to exploring the ocean, scientists and other divers can't thank George Bond and the C-Lab team enough for blazing this trail that led him to the bottom of the sea and opened up new ways of looking at our world. So the History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. And if you like this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends, family, colleagues, mortal enemies, anyone you think would enjoy hearing a history discussion. You can follow HHN on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and check back every week for the next episode. Until then, good luck on this crazy ride called life. Thank you.